Blog Talk Radio. I'm Cynthia Johnson. I'm here with Dr. Reggie Johnson and Gloria Wells. Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good morning, son.
Good morning.
Oh, you know, we are continuing our book study of Breaking Free from Critical Addiction by Kaylee Moreno. And we were so fortunate to have her on the show yesterday as we are laying the foundation for this wonderful, magnificent journey through her book. She's going to be coming back to visit with us during the process of this book study. So I am encouraging you to write down your questions. Email them to Gloria Wells. It's gloria.wells@circlesofprosperity.org. She's going to compile all of those questions, and when Kaylee comes back, we'll be able to ask her, you know, to expand on them, and it'll be great conversation. So I want you guys to really participate in this workshop, and here's one of the reasons why. We are so fortunate that Kaylee is making herself available, and I think it's just wonderful for you to ask questions of her is really showing your love. So I'm asking you as followers of Circles of Prosperity to show your love, show your appreciation, show your gratefulness that someone who has put such a wonderful message out there has come to just talk just to you. I mean, that's a blessing. So, and it gets, you get your answers questioned, and you never know. You may have a major breakthrough for this. You don't know how God is going to work through you or who you will help because you had the courage to ask a question, and it was answered and it helped someone else. So please participate. Please participate. Okay, so Dr. Reggie is going to take us into our morning prayer, and of course we're going to turn this over to Gloria so she can get started this morning. All right, Dr. Reggie?
Mm-hmm. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the stillness of this morning, and that we are healed, and you use us as your divine instruments to convey glorious, miraculous messages. We thank you for Circles of Prosperity, and thank you for Gloria, that you're using her body and her voice and her talent in every way because you gave them to her at birth. Let her keep using them to uphold and bring forth the energy and the love for everybody else that she contacts. Thank you, God, for taking your hands out of the heavens and touching her heart and opening her mind to convey beautiful messages in these works and also in the works of herself that are soon coming out. And thank you for her book that's going to be unfolding that you gave her. We believe it is so, and so it is.
And so it is. Thank you, Dr. Reggie.
Mm-hmm.
And good morning, everybody. It was definitely a very enlightening and fulfilling conversation yesterday with Kaylee. She really was able to give us some more insight on what critical addiction is as compared to critical thinking, as well as some other information she provided to us. It was a very enlightening conversation, and we are going to pick up in our book study today. And yesterday we talked a little bit about symptoms. She gave us a nice beginning to this next section of the book about symptoms. So I'm just going to get started here with that last part of chapter one. We are going to wrap up chapter one hopefully we will get that chapter one wrapped up today. All right, so it's about the inner critic. The symptoms part of this book, she's talking about, let's see, where we're going to start here. How we silence the inner critic manifests in a variety of coping strategies and secondary addictions, which are symptoms of this social disease. These are 10 of the most common ways that we silence the critic. So these 10 reasons that she gave us here are the ways that we have a tendency to just kind of silence that inner critic that is built up in us. One of the ways, the first way actually that she talks about, is perfectionism. She says here in the book that people who are addicted to self-criticism often go under the guise of being a perfectionist, which is a virtuous-sounding title for an advanced form of this disease. Perfectionists can make it sound like they are part of a superior race of beings that have higher standards than others. They claim they don't expect this excellence from others, while those around them feel pressured to excel, compete, or avoid mistakes. Some people assume perfectionists think they are better than others, but that is not really true. Perfectionists actually have feelings of lack or insufficiency that they try to hide from themselves and others. They don't believe that they are good enough, do enough, or have enough. They must constantly strive to prove themselves, whether it is with the perfect body, the cleanest house, the highest sales, etc. Perfectionists are driven by criticism, addiction, and therefore they have great difficulty in just letting go, being spontaneous, and having fun. This is because they are suffering from the tyranny of their own inner critic. All right, so there's the definition of perfectionism. Now, again, as we read through these ways that the inner critic shows up in your life, these are actually not the ways it shows up. These are the ways that we actually try to silence that inner critic. So we talked a little bit yesterday about that. Perfectionism is a really, I think, common. I think that most of us probably strive for some level of perfectionism because it was ingrained in us early on that in order to be the best, you had to do the best, you know? So I think that probably everybody has some measure of perfectionism in their life, but it's just, she's saying that this is the way we silence our inner critic. So I'm going to move on to self-righteousness, prejudice, and bigotry. That's also a way that we try to silence that inner critic. She's saying here that, and please do excuse my voice. I am starting to lose that a little bit. I'm doing a lot of speaking this week with work. So if you're, hopefully it's okay for you, though. All right. So self-righteousness, prejudice, and bigotry are all forms of judgment that produce an artificial high by condemning others. This is a highly addictive form of criticism because it appears to elevate the critics, making them superior to others. Here again, she's talking about that superiority. In the perfectionist, she was just speaking about that too. They have lack of insufficiency. But this is highly addictive. I'm going to pick back up with that paragraph now. Because it appears to elevate the critics, making them superior to others. It lulls users into a false sense of security in which they erroneously believe that they belong to an elite group that is uniquely qualified to make righteous judgments on others. However, the high they get from judging does not last long, forcing the users to constantly find more people to criticize in order to maintain the good feeling. So you see here she's talking not only about these being ways that we silence that inner critic, it's a way that we maintain our own sense of feeling good, you know? So that's part of what this book study is about, is to move us or help us to become aware, I should say, of the places where we're using that inner critic in the wrong way or in not the best way, I should say. So she goes on here to say that condemnation and looking down on others helps these critics feel better about themselves at the expense of others. It is their fix because they set the standards for judgment and can exclude anything they do not want to see about themselves. This form of critical addiction has special appeal to some religious people as a way of avoiding self-examination and feeling the effects of their own judgments. Okay, now she's going into sarcasm now. So we've talked about perfectionism, self-righteousness, prejudice, and bigotry. And now we're going into sarcasm. And she's saying that sarcasm is a covert and seemingly polite way to hide critical and often hostile comments, such as saying, "Don't work too hard," to a person you think is lazy. While those who use sarcasm to hide their hostile feelings may consider this humorous, sarcasm is offensive because it is a verbal attack. Sarcasm also requires a certain level of sophisticated understanding, which may be lacking in people who are very innocent or who have certain forms of brain damage, dementia, and autism. When a person is offended by the sarcasm, the critic often blames the victim by making statements like, "I was just kidding," or, "You're just too sensitive," or, "Can't you take a joke?" Many highly paid comedians have become famous for their sarcasm in ridiculing people for their looks, ethnicity, shortcomings, and handicaps. The audience participates in this form of cruelty when they laugh at the jokes and the person being humiliated, revealing their own judgmental nature and insecurities. So that is what she's saying about sarcasm there. And it goes back a little bit to what she was saying in the first part of this chapter, where she talks about how society values criticism. Also, how criticism is masked by social popularity. So those are ways, some of the ways there that we use to kind of silence this inner critic. Now, the next one that she's talking about is worrying. My goodness, right? I think we certainly all, are...
Gloria.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Before you move into worrying, I wanted mm-hmm. to go back to a couple of these. Do you mind?
Absolutely not. Yes, absolutely. Let's go back and expand on those a little bit.
Yeah, I would like to.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, I'll start with sarcasm, because
mm-hmm.
it's the last one that we talked about. And as you were reading, I thought, and you hit the part about how these paid comedians have become famous for their sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about when I was a kid. And, you know, you hear people talk about playing the dozens.
Yes, definitely.
Your mama was so such and such. And I remember I never understood playing the dozens. All I knew was that it hurt. That's what I remember from it, playing the dozens.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that playing the dozens is part of this sarcasm, and where does it come from? It's very prevalent among African Americans.
Yes.
And so when we look at the consciousness of African Americans and some of the things that we are going through that's been passed down from generation to generation, how do you think this fits into the inner critic of us as African Americans?
Well, I definitely think that it goes back to one of the questions that I asked Kaylee yesterday during our conversation. One of the things that she touched on was the culture. I mentioned that there were two reasons that she mentioned at the beginning of the book. Either we picked critical addiction up from our culture, mm-hmm. or we picked it up as a result of a traumatic experience. So what she said there about the culture was that, you know, this is ingrained in us so early on. You know, she talked about, you know, babies hearing things like, you know, oh, you're so cute, and, oh, you know, you're not so cute, and the baby is taking all this in. So I believe that what you're saying about the sarcasm, especially within our culture, it's something that was ingrained in us very early on to be joking. There was another part of this sarcasm piece that really caught my attention as well. It was saying I'm just playing. That's actually a pet peeve of mine, you know,
mm-hmm.
To say something off the shoulder and say I'm just kidding. You know, that disturbs me because it doesn't feel like it's a joke, and it's very much, you know, sometimes it's just not appropriate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all ways that we just, you know, attempt to silence this inner critic. You know, it's like we have a tendency to overstate some of this stuff because we're trying to hide what's really going on behind this sarcasm.
Exactly. And
behind the perfectionism. Yes.
So as there's a lot of pain,
yes.
and self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking specifically, you know, if a lot of you guys out there who are African Americans can really be honest with yourself and really begin to look at some of these issues within, and I'm not accusing you individually, but maybe you can see where people are in so much pain that they are acting out. And this is why we talk about, why we say that the things that come at you, the people that are standing in front of you, and what you perceive as an attack is really a projection of what's going on inside of you. Do you see where I'm coming from? It's something that's going on inside of you. She says there are hostile, when you're using this mechanism of to cover up your inner critic of sarcasm, there are hostile feelings that are contained within you. So it's that hostility and that self-loathing that really kind of stands out for me. The other one that we just kind of skimmed across
mm-hmm.
and one was the self-righteousness and prejudice and bigotry.
Yes.
Now, and I think I find it very interesting that she has that to come right before sarcasm, and especially when I put this in terms of the racial experience, the cultural experience.
Yes.
Because African Americans, of course, have been historically the brunt of bigotry and prejudice, and have built up this consciousness, a subconsciousness of not being worthy, not feeling enough, and then of course their acting out of that is the sarcasm, which is kind of interesting. And
yes.
and what I also find interesting in these first few symptoms that she's outlined, she really brings in the point that it is an addiction. That
yes.
these, when we have these expressions, that they make us feel good
mm-hmm.
because they're covering up what we really don't feel good about.
Right.
So those were two points that I thought we really should stress, because I don't, just to go through these and not take the time to really analyze what they are. I want to, if someone is experiencing this, I want them to understand. Look, wake up.
Mm-hmm.
If you have these feelings, you need to go through and find out why you're having these feelings, and recognize that it is an addiction
yes.
to make yourself feel good.
Definitely. And then also the one you didn't touch on there was the perfectionism.
Oh,
that was also that was also a big one there, because I think that, you know, that's one that can certainly be like the sarcasm and the self-righteousness. I think ultimately people know underneath those two issues that they're not coming from a good place, you know, when you're being self-righteous or prejudiced or sarcastic. But with perfectionism, I think that that's one that wouldn't readily jump out as necessarily an issue for people, always having to have everything perfect in their life. It says there that the perfectionist actually has feelings of lack and insufficiency that they are hiding from themselves and others. They don't believe they're good enough, that they do enough, or they have enough. So, and that this is like a way to like prove themselves. So that inner critic that's being hidden by perfectionism is one of I'm not enough. So that inner critic behind perfectionism is truly I'm not enough, I'm not worthy enough, and I don't have enough, and I don't do enough. So that perfectionism shows up as a way for them to express their enoughness, you know. So mm-hmm. that one may not be as obvious as an inner critic symptom, the perfectionism, as the other ones that you mentioned.
But I will say this. This is me. I am the perfectionist.
Okay.
I am. And honestly, and see, this is why I think it's so important to try to expand on these.
Yes.
I recognize this characteristic in me now. And here's what I used to say when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
I am harder on myself than I will be on anyone else.
Mm.
I do a lot of self-examination. If I found myself in a conflict, I'm constantly, where did I go wrong? What did I say wrong? How could I have dealt with this differently? So I am my harshest critic, but
mm-hmm.
and I display it in other, and I work very, very hard to make sure everything I do is perfect. Everything, the house has to be a certain way, the dishes have to be a certain way, my cabinets have to be organized a certain way, and all of that is because I'm trying to prove that I am worthy.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm totally honest, I just feel that I'm not worthy. Some of that is from, you know, growing up in a household with two parents from, you know, the segregated South that were
mm-hmm.
feeding into me that, you know, if you're black, you have to be better than everyone else.
Yes.
Just to even make it in the world, you know. So I became an overachiever because of that. I mean, I can be, you know, I can lay it all out there and see it. It doesn't seem like it's a lot of harm, but yes, on the end, it's hard to keep up. And when you feel that you haven't reached a level of success that reaches that's going to satisfy some pinnacle, I don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
Then you really begin to have feelings of failure. I've gone through all of that. So I definitely recognize this. I think I intentionally didn't go back to look at it because,
mm-hmm.
you know me, I'm going to share what's going on in my life.
yes, definitely. Definitely.
I didn't want everybody to know, oh, God, Cynthia, but if you're around me, you know that I am a perfectionist. And I'll go, well, honey, do you, Reggie, I'll tell you, it makes him crazy. I never do anything right. I'm always saying, honey, you know, you think you could do such and such and such and such. I put it off on other people, but I don't mean any harm. So if you guys hear me and I treat you that way, just pull my coattail and say, Cynthia, I hear.
Well, I think that also that one coming first as the very first symptom that she described, you know, it tells you how prevalent that is in our society. So I don't think that it's anything anyone should be, you know, taking in a personal way, but certainly take the time to recognize that you may have some of these symptoms. And we are going to move into an area of the book that will continue to help us let go of some of these symptoms that we've been holding on to as a means of covering up a much deeper issue, whether
mm-hmm.
it's feeling worthy enough or good enough, safe enough, happy enough, secure enough, whatever it is that you may not have gotten enough of as a younger person, as a child or as a young adult, you know, we've internalized a lot of this stuff, and a lot of this stuff is preventing us from really moving forward in our lives the way we would really like to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we're going to go ahead and move on to worrying then, which is there's two really big ones in here. Worrying is one of them as far as I'm concerned, and then anger is the other one. I think that one deserves, like, a whole anger, deserves a show of its own, you know, because that is just a huge topic. But let's read through the worrying, and then we'll comment a little bit on what the worrying does here. Okay, so worriers have that sounds like warriors, doesn't it? But it's not. It's worriers have a critical view of the future with little faith in others. Our society has taught many of us that responsible people worry. Worry is a negative habit that causes some people to feel fearful and anxious while also feeling important because they believe that they are responsible for others by worrying about them. They keep their inner critic focused on others and finding fault with them. This is quite nonsensical when you think about it. Being fearful does not prevent problems. Worry never paid a bill. I love that line. Worry never paid a bill, okay? Taking action to do something that will change a circumstance is helpful, but simply worrying just produces negative feelings. Worriers sometimes create a lot of drama, which brings attention to themselves, seeing impending doom rallies others to support them. Habitual worriers are often worry warts. They spend their time worrying, often thinking that worrying is genuinely productive. While worrying does not reap a benefit, it can actually cause a host of physical problems like high blood pressure, stomach issues, and on top of that, worriers upset others and typically engage in additional addictions to soothe their fears. Alcohol is a common drug of choice for worriers because it depresses anxiety. All right, so that's what she has to say about worrying. And again, you know, I had to stop on the one that says worrying never paid a bill, you know. And it's also interesting that she says that we actually think we're helping people when we're worrying about them, you know, that we're worrying to somehow make a situation better when actually worry only adds fear to that situation. It doesn't really, it's non-productive to sit back and worry about anybody. So, Cynthia, what are your comments on that part about worrying?
Oh, well, I'm going to go back to one of Dr. Reggie's statements. He says, worry is a spiritual sickness.
Mm-hmm.
Worry is a spiritual sickness because it's actually producing the end result is going to be exactly what you're worrying about. So all of these scenarios that you are manufacturing in your mind as you worry about them, you are actually creating those scenarios, and you actually experience them. So it's a spiritual sickness. I totally get it. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that she also talks about the inner critic. So I like when she points out the inner critic within the symptom. In this particular case, she says that the inner critic is focused on fault-finding with others. Remember, to be critical is to either find fault with someone else or yourself. So that finding fault with someone else is what generates the worry. You know, so in order for me to worry about someone, I have to literally think something is wrong with them for me to sit and take time to worry about them. Do you see how that is being critical as well when you're worrying about a person or a situation? What you're really saying is something is wrong with that situation that I need to take the time to either try to fix or correct or do something about. Now, doing something about the situation is not necessarily a quote-unquote bad thing. It taking action is actually a good thing. That is one of the aspects of critical thinking. The way she clarified that for us yesterday, when you're actually taking the time to do something to add to a situation in some way, shape, or form, then that's actually a constructive form of taking action. But to just sit back and worry about someone or something is fault-finding in that person or that situation. So that's how you're hiding the inner critic behind the worry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think our worry also covers up fear. She says here that being fearful doesn't prevent a problem. And a lot of times the situations we're thinking fearful thoughts and thinking the worst case scenarios and spending a lot of time visualizing what it's going to feel like to be in the worst case scenario. You're creating it at that point. Here's the other thing that she brings out. And I think culturally, as African Americans, there's a lot of we worry on a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
And if you notice, high blood pressure is very prevalent among African Americans.
Yes.
And I have always felt that that was generated by stressors that we really don't recognize as stressors in our life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That is so buried and so much a part of our DNA. Of course, I'm taking this all the way back to Bruce Lipton's work about DNA, which I'm not going to repeat here. But it's almost some of these feelings of our self-worth and not feeling good enough and always constantly trying to prove who we are and that we're capable. All of that now is just in our DNA. It's a part of our makeup. It's been handed down from our mothers, actually, in the bloodstream. And so I believe that is what is causing high blood pressure to be so prevalent among us. And we have to do a lot of deep work in order to shift it. But I will say this, that miracles can happen and the change can be instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll move into those steps in order to make these changes in our life later on in the book. But if you have the faith and you can trust and let go, you can release these feelings almost instantaneously. If not, you can release them slowly as time goes on. And so don't beat yourself up that we're talking about these things or that you may be, you can identify some of these qualities within you because you can overcome them, and that's the journey we're taking. So let's go ahead and move into denial and secrecy.
Okay. All right. So she's saying there that when people don't own their actions or mistakes, and when they cannot accept responsibility for themselves, they often use denial and secrecy as a self-defense. Denial and secrecy are used in the traditional macho ideal of manhood. According to this ideal, a man must always be strong, courageous, aggressive, and unemotional, and right. Any weaknesses must be denied. According to this doctrine, a real man is not allowed to have feelings, make mistakes, or be wrong. Emotions, errors, and weakness are hidden within denial and secrecy. Since people do not notice things for which they have no label or frame of reference, many men have not developed an internal dialogue that languages their emotions.
No, let's stop there for a moment.
Yes. Yeah, I think that first paragraph was pretty full, wasn't it?
It was very full.
Yes.
You know, we have men here on Circles of Prosperity. And Anthony and Cody, if you guys can chime in here and give us women, because we have a lot of women here, to some insight into how you you deal with this whole macho thing and what you're feeling and the emotions that you have inside that you have felt, because I know you guys have really grown so much. But how did you break free? What can you tell us the process or share that with us? Oh, I knew we would get a call. I love these guys. They always jump in. Good morning, Cody.
Too.
How are you, baby?
Well, baby, I'm just dealing with, you know, my cold and everything, but I find the subject most interesting. And growing up, most men, and I can only speak for just me and being a black man, we have so many different concepts as the book put out there. We think that not crying and all of that is an indication of manhood, but nothing could be further from the truth. A real man do cry, you know. A real man do, realizes that he's caring, he can care, he can be considerate and everything else. Sometimes men are too considerate, if there's such a thing. And I just think that this is a powerful book, but definitely the macho man, I think, is, I would like to say it's a thing of the past, but it isn't. But it's certainly on its way out. I think most men realize now the value of crying and cleansing the soul, being caring, loving, considerate. Of course, we still got other issues that we have to work on. But certainly this is a good book in terms of it opening the door to some of the things that challenges how men have thought and felt for so long, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Did you ever feel like I can't cry, I can't show my emotions, or that it made you feel that you were weak if you had those feelings?
Growing up in Baltimore and being hanging around the crowds that I hung around, I had to, even though I knew I was a marshmallow, I had to project this thing of toughness, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember in game fights, one particular North Avenue and Howe Street, so long ago, and I was scared to death. I'm standing there with a hatchet, and I was scared to death, hoping I didn't have to cut nobody, because I knew inside of me I was not that tough guy. A lot of times men do that. You know, we have to be accepted. And what is really critical is as a child or a man child growing up without a father in this house, who he cannot get no identity from because he don't have none. I grew up with a mother and four sisters. So I like to say, I won't quite say what that is, but that's a whole lot of something in the house, mine is me. You understand? You know?
Yeah.
I saw them, you know what I mean? During that time, they go for the sanitary napkins and all that. But that's something else. But what I wanted to say was, a man has got to go out and get it from another man. Learn what it is to be a man. You have to, you know, you cannot get it from women, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As sweet and precious as you are, you cannot tell me how to be a man. But you know one thing you showed me is how to express your feelings. Women don't have a problem expressing their feelings.
That's right.
You know, most of them don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so much so that a man might not really appreciate all that expression. But it's okay. What I wanted to say, and I'm going to cut it short, is that it is no joke learning what it is to be a man. And when you go down this life's highway here, there's so many pitfalls. There's so many misconceptions of what it takes to be a man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some think it's materialistic value. Some think it's muscles. Some think it's never saying I'm sorry. You know, people say I won't apologize, you know what I mean. Or they say, I forget exactly how it goes. They'll say I apologize, but they won't say I'm sorry. And to me, I don't know the difference in the word, because the ball means the same to me. But I want to say this, and I just think this is a powerful lesson. But as men, we are coming around and realize we have a lot to learn. You know, we have a lot to learn. And that ego is always, and I think that is because we want to feel big and as a giant in your eyes, because we know on the other side of the fence, we're not a giant. So when we got to come home, you know, it reminds me of my father when he was doing construction work back in the 50s. They gave his tail the blues, you know what I mean? So when he came home, his only way of expressing his man masculinity or whatever the word is for it, would take it out on my mother and us, you know what I mean? Because somewhere he was trying to feel like a man. But that's a whole different subject. We could be on that for 2 days. But what I'm saying, and that's something that is, yes, it is time to learn what a real man does. And he cries, he feels, he has compassion, he makes mistakes, you know. But that sarcasm got me in particular because I'm quick. I used to call it quick-witted. I was always quick-witted with something, say something smart. But when I look at it, I realize I did that to you first so you could not see who I really was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's covering up the inner critic, yes.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much for sharing. We're getting close to the end of the hour, 45-minute lesson this morning. I'm going to go ahead and let Gloria try to wrap up the other symptoms very quickly, Gloria.
Well, it's just going to be the rest of denial and secrecy. I think anger, like I said, we could do an entire show on anger alone, so we'll pick up with anger tomorrow.
Pick up with anger tomorrow.
And so, yeah, we'll finish out the denial and secrecy here. Mm-hmm. Just this last, this talks a little bit about what he was just saying about men. It says here that there was a time in history when a man's survival depended on looking outside for the cause of pain. So there was a time when they literally had to survive and had to be very aware of what was outside of them for that pain, but so that they could defend against physical attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like really, really ingrained for men. I mean, all the way down to the genetics, it appears.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, this is rarely true in most civilized societies. More and more men are allowed to be humans, make mistakes, which is exactly what Cody was just saying, and have feelings,
mm-hmm.
and still be considered good, strong men. After all, it takes a strong person to own up to his or her own mistakes. So that just is another way of talking about how we mask that inner critic,
mm-hmm.
and then also how to get beyond that. So I think that's a good place for us to end there today, and then we will pick up with the anger on tomorrow. And like I said, we will probably spend quite a bit of time tomorrow dealing with anger because of all the symptoms, of all the 10 symptoms that she lists. And from my own personal perspective and looking out into the world, I think anger, people being angry about things that they can't change or want to change, is like if we can bust through that, at least bring some awareness to that. What you were saying earlier, Cynthia, was absolutely true. We're not giving this information out for people to start judging themselves or feeling bad or having a pity party on themselves about who they are. This is about awareness. This is about bringing those things to the table, shining the light and love and truth on them, and allowing them to transform and transmute into a better way of being in this world. That's what this is about.
Oh, amen. Dr. Reggie, can you take us into our closing prayer?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Father, for this beautiful lesson today. And I hope we listen to this lesson very carefully and ingrain this lesson in our hearts and minds. And above all attitudes, above all symptoms, above all feelings, the most important one is to love ourselves and share that love with others. And not wallow in anger and upsetment and other forms of delusion. Thank you, God, for this message. Let's take it to heart and soul. We believe it is so as we walk in the Holy Spirit, and so it is.
And so,
so it is.
Wow. We'll see you guys tomorrow. We're going to pick up with anger, and you guys have a blessed, blessed day.